This is the Goalkeeper Roundtable, hosted by Dr. Bill Steffen, with Jeff Shook, George Costellas, and Dave LaTourette. Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Goalkeeper Roundtable. Today's episode is a special one because we have a guest on for the second time. Although, you didn't hear it the first time. Today, it's Adelaide Gay. Adelaide is a former collegiate goalkeeper in the United States playing for Yale University and the University of North Carolina. She has multiple professional experiences, especially in Europe, where she's played in Iceland, Sweden, Norway, and now Denmark. We had a great conversation with Addie, and I hope you enjoy it too. She brings a great perspective to the position, to the game, and to how she views playing in Europe as a female. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode with Dr. Bill, GK, Shooky, Lotto, and the Scandinavian Traveler.
Far, and so they created this team here in Farum, Denmark called FCN, where they bring players in. They have lots of young players from everywhere, not just Ghana. There's like Ivory Coast, there's other, I just met a whole bunch of them because some of them live in the hotel here as well, but from other teams in Scandinavia. And the whole purpose is, I think they have the youngest men's team in Europe. So the whole purpose is to develop this young talent and then sort of sell them to bigger clubs throughout
Europe. There's got to be something there because, again, at Wingate, they have a player. He's actually, because of COVID and not playing, he just went back to Denmark, but he's Paul Ngonko. So he's, I don't know where his roots are, but obviously they're African, and he's Danish. And he was just a brilliant player. I mean, I forget the team he signed with in Denmark, but he's back in Denmark playing. This is a good
I don't know the men's team yet. I wish I did. Otherwise, I probably know.
George, you had something.
Well, no, I just wanted to add to it because I'm pretty familiar with Right to Dream, and my experience was actually on the recruiting path where a lot of those Ghanaian or opportunities have been provided towards them to come to the United States and actually go to school. And a number of them would actually attend, high-level prep schools. I know the Hotchkiss program was one of the first to have the Right to Dream program. So great opportunity and obviously a great organization.
Yeah, it's really cool. Like I'm just getting to know it now. And we actually had a meeting yesterday where they announced a new investor and they're building another Right to Dream in Egypt. And through that announcement, I kind of got to learn a little bit more about it, but it's definitely a cool, interesting culture and program.
Cool, very good, very good. We were also chatting a little bit about the weather. Jeff didn't want to talk much about the weather because of his situation in Michigan and it being a little chilly. What's your situation in terms of, number one, is it fit to train outside? Number two, are you training outside? If not, how do you adapt yourself to training when it's not hospitable outside?
Yeah, so actually it's funny because obviously Scandinavia is very, very cold. I've played in Iceland, which is probably the wettest and the coldest. And even where I was in Norway last year, you know, it was still on the coast. And so it was very windy and rainy a lot of times. But so far it's been cold here, but because you're in that big stadium, you don't feel if there is wind. I haven't really felt it so much so far. I mean, I've only been here 2 weeks training for a week. So it's been cold, but not wet really. So I've found the weather to be not so bad. We train at 7:30 in the morning most days, so it is quite cold. But for me, cold is not so bad. It's more the wind and the rain that get you.
Okay, what surface are you playing on?
Turf.
Okay.
It's nice though. It's looks new. It's new turf. Nice surface.
Good. Turf again. For me, I'd rather go on not frozen ground, but I'd rather go on cold ground than cold turf. I think it's, I don't know, maybe a little bit more forgiving. and a little more playable.
I don't notice so much on the diving, but you do get the turf does freeze. Like, you know, you get, it gets pretty slick. I mean, there was one day we had the balls, and I'm not sure if this is because they wash them before and after every training, but they were just coated in ice. So sometimes it's a bit slippery, but I don't notice it, the firmness of it so much as the sometimes icy and slippery, especially on your first touch, you know?
Well, but again, when you're scrimmaging, that's got to, obviously, that's going to affect the speed of play.
Yeah.
So is it, given you're training now and you're going to be playing, when do you officially open your season?
So we have, the Danish season is actually, this is mid-season for them. So they had a half a season in the fall. We have our first training matches Sunday, so day after tomorrow. And then we have a couple more training games. We play a cup game. And then we have two games that were postponed because of COVID from the fall. And then the second half of the season starts. And the second half is like a championship where the top six teams basically have a home and home, and you get a certain number of points based on how you finished in the fall. It's an interesting system because you have a larger league in the fall, and then the bottom two or four teams, I forget, they go into a league with the players that are coming up from the second division, and they play off to see who basically.
So it's a battle for relegation or to maintain your spot, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Your teams change very much in player makeup on the two halves?
They added, our team added three players in this window. I'm not sure about other teams. This team is a little bit interesting in the sense that, you know, there's two traditionally really good women's teams in Denmark that go to Champions League every year. And there's another team that's sort of up and coming. And then this team, which the men's side has now made this investment in the women. So they're kind of building the program still. And from my understanding, there's been a lot of turnover with players between the seasons. So my guess is that it's probably not a lot, but maybe one or two in each window would be my guess. I don't know.
Interesting. I'll tell you what, Addie, just to give everybody, I mean, we were chatting before about the different places you've played. If you could just tell people, you know, Iceland, Denmark, Norway, and stuff like that, as well as any differences you've noticed in the play within those leagues. And hey, no holds barred if you want to talk about standards of play being, you know, like this, whatever, but just to give people an idea, maybe if you've noticed differences in the play in any of these different settings you've played in.
Yeah, it's interesting. People usually ask me, you know, Europe versus the US, and I would say that's obviously the biggest difference. You know, the US is a very athletic league, you know, players will just run you into the ground, basically, not as technical, tactical, but not in the sense of, you know, most female American teams are, they want to be the team that is like high pressing the most, going to goal the quickest, that kind of stuff. So it definitely has its tactical stuff, but it's not necessarily like maybe a very technical league. It's very athletic. Whereas the Scandinavian countries, for the most part, are pretty technical, pretty tactical, and definitely are sort of working on the athletic side, I guess you should say. Like, we ran the yo-yo test 2 days ago, and I wouldn't say that that is something that I've seen as common in Scandinavia. Some teams, but it's pretty sporadic. It's not, okay, we're going to run it every year, or we're going to run it 3 times a year, et cetera. So, in terms of between the leagues, the Norwegian league, I would say, is the most physical. The girls are bigger, and there's just a lot more collisions, I guess you could say.
Challenges.
Yeah, challenges. The Swedish league is maybe the most like playing league. The Icelandic league was pretty tough as well, but when you're talking about the different services, it's interesting because Iceland is the only one that I've seen where most of the teams play on grass. So the game feels a bit slower because, you know, it's not being played on turf, where the game feels really fast sometimes. You know, it's different. Like, the Icelandic league has, you know, five teams that are really good and five teams that maybe aren't as good. whereas the Swedish league is maybe a little bit stronger overall. Don't know much about the Danish league yet. The Norwegian league, they just cut it down from 12 teams to 10 teams. So I would say the level across those is pretty good, but there still are those few teams that are really good, have more money, that kind of stuff. So a lot of differences.
Yep. George, go ahead.
Maddie, in regards to those differences, I'm just wondering about how did it impact you and how you approached your goalkeeping, whether it was something technical, tactical, maybe just based off maybe the system of play, just how did it impact you as a goalkeeper?
Yeah, I think as my career has gone on, I've really tried hard to get on teams that fit my playing style more than, you know, in the beginning, you kind of just want to play for whoever and maybe they don't know much about you personally. But for me, obviously, like I want to be on a team that plays out, you know, my skills are with my feet. I would rather play on a team that plays high pressing with a high line because I can clean stuff up in behind. I don't really want to play for a team that's going to sit in and just let balls get dumped in and try to win headers and stuff like that, which there are lots of teams that are successful that way. Especially, you know, there were a couple of teams in Norway that were successful using that, you know? So, but that's, you know, I always say to coaches, I'm like, if that's what you want to do, I'm not the goalkeeper for you. So it's tough though, because you don't always know, right? So like, you know, the team I played on in Norway last year was really successful the year before, lost a whole bunch of players. And I think we wanted to play out and we wanted to play a higher style, but a lot of games we were just sort of clinging on for dear life. So in that case, yes, like I did have to adapt a bit more to what was needed. But that's also kind of the exciting thing about soccer, right? You, as a goalkeeper, especially, you have to be what your team needs you to be. And obviously it's easier if that plays into your strengths, but if it doesn't, then I guess you kind of learn a new skill.
Well, you face a new challenge, you face,
yeah,
and you develop a new skill or new understanding of what's necessary, you know, to manage the game at that point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Lotto, you had something.
I love the background.
I'm muted though. Now I'm not muted. Two questions. One is just sort of a curiosity question. And you talked about surfaces, you know, you talked about Iceland being predominantly on grass, and then these other countries, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, et cetera, playing on synthetic surface, which makes sense considering the weather and the damage it would do to a field, especially if you have both a men's and a women's team playing on the same surface or on the same stadium. But just out of curiosity, when we say synthetic, I mean, there are some fields that are garbage synthetic. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, they're still using the black drum rubber, the pile length isn't high, they're compacted, they're hard. And I'm saying this from experience. You know, for instance, we're getting a new field built at school. And as we speak, I drove by today and they're demolishing all the old stuff and they're starting to, and we're actually going to have a grass. We're going to go, it was originally a grass facility, went to turf, and we're going back to grass. But you know, baseball, softball will stay synthetic. So in terms of it, like what plays more like it'll never be grass, but some will play more like grass, and not have the black crumb rubber, but have some sort of organic infill. You know, you just don't get all that crap in you. Just what are your thoughts, or what are you seeing there in terms of their evolution of knowing that they have to play on those synthetic surfaces? And are they, you know, are they better or the new, I would say the newer, more advanced surfaces?
Yeah. So that's why it was interesting when you asked about here, what the surface was. I was like, it's turf, but it's really nice. It's obviously new. It's obviously, you know, maybe 2-3 years old max, you know, you can just tell it's a new surface and it's the green fill. So it's not the black pellets. I don't know exactly what it is, but yeah, you can just get a sense when you're like, oh, the turf's completely flat, it's old, you know, like they can brush it as much as they want. It's not really gonna come back to life. So obviously I've been on fields that sort of run the gamut. Like when I was in Sweden, they actually changed out our turf between seasons because we moved up to the highest league, and the league or the team, I don't know, was probably like, no, you can't play on this surface. Yeah,
you probably had to have it, because at a certain level, if you're playing at the level that you're at, it's mandatory that you have a quote FIFA approved surface. And if it's not, you can't play any matches on it.
Yeah. And they really try in a lot of the leagues to have, a certain standard. So when we moved up, they had to build 800 covered seats and change out the turf and all that kind of stuff. So that was good, but it's interesting because I feel like we really did have an advantage on our field before that, just because it played really fast, and you could see teams come in and they're just overhitting their passes. It's just rolling all the way down the field and out of bounds. So, I think it definitely varies. And obviously if you're paired with a men's club, the surface for the most part, there are women's clubs that, have their own good cash flows and stuff like that. But, it seems like the services are a bit better if you're in, like we're in the stadium, it's like, going to be a really nice service.
Right. It's good. It's good to hear that. I say it because we played on a surface that was so bad. I mean, it was horrible. We shouldn't have been playing on it. And I can say that, and I've said that for a few years, to the point where we had to adapt sessions. The difference between when we play an away match on a good synthetic surface or a grass field, the way the guys would feel after the match and the next day and how they'd recover, significantly different, so it was, we learned that over time. As it got worse and worse, we had to adapt that. So sort of random question, but just curious in terms of how the foreign or international clubs are doing that. So my second question is, in terms of culturally, you've been in, your fourth country now. In terms of culture, you're probably somewhat resilient and malleable in terms of being able to, because you've stayed there so long, where other players go and they just come home because they don't enjoy it or they struggle with it. Speak to the differences in culture a little bit, maybe from country to country, but also maybe as a broad perspective from those countries you're in to the U.S. And I'd say culturally, maybe more as it leans towards the game and how it's looked at and viewed and you're treated there as opposed to maybe here.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, and I can't speak for everyone who's had experiences in Scandinavia, but generally speaking, they take very good care of you. The standard of living is quite high, and obviously there's always going to be issues, especially in women's soccer, where there's certain teams that have trouble finding good housing and all that kind of stuff. But I've always been treated very well. And so it's been easy. Everyone speaks English. And for the most part, they don't mind speaking English. It's not like it's a hassle or anything, which makes a difference when you're far from home. I think culturally, for the most part, and I hate to lump them all together because the people are so different in the different countries, but I would say overall they're more reserved, more obedient to authority, I guess you could say. The kids are very respectful and almost to the point where, I'm like, oh, well, it's fine, we'll just do this. And they're like, oh no, like we can't do that, And so I think it's, the American personality is a bit more, I hate to say rebellious because I don't even think that describes me very well. But there definitely is sort of like a willful streak in a lot of the Americans that you don't see as much. We're obviously louder. You could always hear the Americans at practice just like saying goodness knows what, but that said, I also think, when you're loud, people start to, you start to get the traits of one another as well, So my Swedish team, I feel like when I first got there was like very quiet. And then by the end, it was very, very loud and sort of different. So, and by the same token, I think players, if you're over here for long enough, maybe get a bit more reserved. So I think you kind of all rub off on each other, but those are kind of the big, big differences maybe.
Well, it happens a little bit in the opposite when kids come here. We've had a Swedish player and two Norwegian players in the last 7 or 8 years that come over on an exchange. They typically stay for 2 semesters. It's just some sort of exchange program that they run, and they kind of come in very reserved, very quiet. They almost seem initially intimidated or shy, and you realize that's just them culturally. And then by the time that they leave, they pick up more of that outgoing, and they show their inner personality a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. George, you had something. George, unmute.
Thank you, Billy. Obviously, leading up to your professional career and in these experiences, you've had different coaches, you know, and obviously you've now been in different countries and have dealt with a number of different goalkeeper coaches. And my belief is those experiences shape us. You know, there's always something we can take away. So I'm just wondering from your experience, what have you taken away from, and it doesn't necessarily just have to be a goalkeeper coach, but just those experiences, what have you taken away from those opportunities?
Yeah, it's so interesting because I feel like, especially when you're talking about a professional environment and, you know, women, I think people expect something when you get to that level. You expect, you know, everything to be super organized, and you're expecting I'm gonna have a goalkeeper coach every single day, and they're gonna know exactly what they're talking about, and everything's gonna be taken care of. Because in a way, like, if you're playing at a high level college program, you already have that, so you expect that that's gonna continue into the professional game, and it certainly is the case in some places. But the women's game is just so unpredictable that, you know, a lot of places, like my goalkeeper coach last year in Norway, he is also a police officer. My goalkeeper coach is pretty much everywhere I've played overseas have had other jobs that they do during the day. So some days they won't be there, or, you know, they're working the night shift or whatever. And so you kind of, I think a lot of people are like, oh, well, this is not good enough because they're not here, or, this is not good enough because the session's not planned, et cetera. And there's like a lot of different ways where you can sort of say, oh, this isn't what I expected. And I think for me, kind of like you were saying, I do think that you learn something from every environment. And just because it's not perfect doesn't mean that you're not learning. And, you know, some of those coaches have been the most helpful to me in my career. Like my goalkeeper coach in Iceland and my goalkeeper coach in Norway were both very, supportive, I guess you could say. Like my Icelandic coach, he was very much like, you don't give yourself enough credit, like you're very quick, here's what you're good at. Like he would always stay after, he'd pick me up on my days off and you know, train me. He, you know, gave me a leg of one of his lambs that he had
you did well. Here's my lamb.
yeah exactly. He picked me up
two legs.
Yeah. He picked me up one day for training, and there was just a leg of meat in a plastic bag in the front seat. And I was like, oh my gosh, is that your dinner? And he's like, oh, that's for you. And I was like, oh, ha. And then
that's the former goalkeeper.
Oh yeah, I know, right? And he drops me off and he's like, you forgot your meat. And I was like, oh, that actually is for me. That's so sweet. So, yeah, anyway, so, yeah, you learn something from every goalkeeper coach, and they're all a little different. I love the different ways that goalkeeper coaches coach. You know, the American way is one way, and I think it's great. And I think some of the best experiences I've had have been training with Jill Boyden or Nathan Thackeray from The Courage, and just the way that they set up the sessions are very professional, and they've thought through every single element. So you're working on multiple things at one time. And so in a lot of ways, like, that is sort of like the gold standard in goalkeeper training. But at the same time, there's also this sort of soft silence science of, you know, the psychological component and stuff, and just different ways of coaching. My Norwegian coach, he was very much into repetitions of diving, where you knew where the ball was going. You know, I feel like in the US, they're very much like, don't move until the ball is struck, you know, to sort of work on your reactions and not leaving early, cheating in quotes. But I actually found it really helpful because you're sort of ingraining that movement pattern into your body. And then obviously you need to be set and react to the shot, but I found that helpful. So that was something that was different than something that you would normally get from an American goalkeeper coach maybe, but yeah.
Well, no, if you see a different bunch of stars, I think you've got a great attitude because, as you said, you could take something from everybody and this works for me. This didn't work for me. This will work for so-and-so. I know them. They would probably like this and things like that. So it's great. Mm-hmm. First off, it's great to have the experiences with all these different kinds of coaches, which I think is beneficial for your overall training. Mm-hmm. But it also is good to help you appreciate the educational side of it. So that's great. Jeff, did you have something? I saw your hand up a second ago.
Yeah, just curious. How many goalkeepers are on the team in camp every day training? And are you guys on a rotation for games, or is it player who's most on form stays in and plays?
So here I'm just sort of like getting used to everybody who's on the team. There are two other goalkeepers. And I would say normally there's usually like a starter, there's a reserve keeper, and then there's like a young keeper. And, you know, maybe it depends on where you are, basically. But for the most part, foreigners, meaning Americans or pretty much from other countries, they're expensive. So like if you have a local player, you might pay them, but you're not going to pay them a full professional salary necessarily, you know, while they're still in school, or they might also be working at the same time. So you don't usually bring in a foreign player unless you're intending to play them. That doesn't mean that you can't lose your spot. Absolutely, especially if you're at the end of your contract and they're trying to figure out whether they can use who's already there or they, you know, or to re-sign you. So there's definitely still competition in there. But, you know, I would say it's, you know, relatively set on who they think they're going to play. And then after that, I guess it's a bit more fluid.
Now, having said that, is that to the coaches in general, and again, please speak for individuals if you need to, but is the training geared towards the starter or just the training geared towards the group?
I would say in general, especially the goalkeeper training is that's an interesting question, because especially now, you know, the sessions, like I haven't given a ton of input on like what I would like to do more of or less of, because it's our first week. Definitely on other teams throughout the season, the coach usually, as a goalkeeper coach, will usually say like, what do you want to work on? Or here's what I think we should work on. And it will be geared toward, you know, a goal that was scored or, you know, yeah, what you need to work on. But for the most part, everyone's still getting the same amount of reps. And, you know, that's pretty important for me because I've been on both sides of that. And I definitely don't want to be that goalkeeper that just takes all the reps because I can. So I think for the most part, it's pretty even. Obviously there's situations where, you know, starters versus reserves, you know, so you're probably going to be with the defense that you're going to be playing with on the weekend. And I'm assuming as we get closer to season, there'll be more of that. Obviously when it's still preseason, you're sort of playing with everybody and figuring out what works, but, yeah. Did that answer your question?
No. You kind of did, because again, if as things moved along, if they're asking you, what do you think you need to work on, as opposed to asking, you know, the reserve, what do you think you need to work on? Well, yeah, but we can't do that now. Maybe you'll have to do that on some other point at some other time along the way.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do think it's probably more geared toward what the starter would like to work on.
Have you noticed in your career playing with a four-back or a three-back system differences?
Yeah, so I've actually played quite a bit with a three-back. I mean, that's what UNC played when I was there. Yeah. And I would say it's like probably more, I probably enjoy playing a three-back more than a four-back if it's played as a three and not as a five. If it's played as a five, I don't really, you know, that's not great because then you have no pressure higher up the field. But yeah, I played a three back in college. I played a three back in Iceland. And we went back and forth last year with a three back, four back. So they're two very different systems. And I don't know if they're different in the men's game than the women's game. Cause I think when you watch the men's game, the three back doesn't really, in my opinion, look the same as it looks in the women's game, because it does end up coming into that five more often, I feel like. But yeah, there's a lot of differences to me with a three back playing a high line and trying to just sort of have more pressure up the field versus a four back, which is more pressure cover balance type of thing. Whereas with three, you're almost playing, you almost have to play it like it's three center backs. So they're stepping and dropping at the same time a lot of the time.
So you'd find, and again, obviously I'm familiar with Carolina's three back system, and I know that as you as you mentioned, it does play high. You find yourself playing higher at, in goal. Yeah. You have to play yourself being higher because you are literally, you know, cleaning up anything that gets by.
Yeah, absolutely. And I prefer that. I, you know, I would prefer having a ball played over the top and then you just come and clean it up versus, you know, slowly inching back towards the goal, you know? So I'd rather have maybe one or two breakaways in a game versus, yeah, setting up shop in our end. But obviously a four back, you can also play very aggressively. The Courage play, you know, with their outside backs higher than their tens most of the time. So, I mean, you can definitely play a four back aggressively as well. But yeah.
Yeah. We, you can see, you've seen some teams play out of four in the back where their two outside backs become essentially their two wide midfielders, which become their two wide attacking players. And they'll hold one of their central midfielders, will hold the six, and they play with a little, like, almost, you almost end up with a little triangle, but it makes for a very narrow three back when it looks that way too.
Yeah.
Cool. No, I asked that also because, and I think I shared with some of the fellows here, the differences in running demands on players in different systems. The backs have to run more in certain systems than in others. So that's, it's interesting with that. As you go, you're saying you're just getting yourself back into form right now and getting involved with the team. What particular things would you do if you've got a break, if you have a 2-month gap where you're not playing? What's your training like during those 2 months that you are exiting one portion of a season or a season and then about to begin another in 2 months? What would your training be like?
Yeah, so I think to me, especially after you're in a long season, the rest phase is actually really important. I think the older I get, the more I realize you do have to like shut down a bit just for the health of your body and mentally a bit. Last year was the first year where we didn't have a mid-season break. So, you know, we got there in February and just the way it worked out, it was like a perpetual preseason until June. There wasn't really like, oh, you know, some teams said take a month off and then we'll get into it. But our team kind of just trained right through. And so by the end in the middle of December, you know, there's just a general sense of exhaustion, I guess you'd say, especially mentally playing every single weekend. And we didn't do that well. So every single weekend was like, how are we going to win this weekend? And you kind of get into that grind. So I think the first and foremost thing is if you've had a long season, just take a break. And then for me, it's always been just physical things. So lifting, that's like a time when you can really build strength. I think it's hard to build strength in season just because of the demands, and you want to be explosive. So you don't want to be just lifting a ton of weight all the time. So that's a great time to build strength. And, you know, I feel like the goalkeeper component, your touches on the ball, you know, obviously keep playing here and there, but I think the physical component is what you can really get into in the off season that you have, is hard in season. So especially when you have a long 10-month season, that's like a good time to just focus on that more.
And so you're saying then like in the, let's say 4 weeks before your opening, that's when you would start your strength training, or would you start it before then and then taper towards the beginning of the season?
Yeah. I mean, 2 months is obviously not a very long off season. You know, that's sort of a, yeah, maybe take 2 weeks off and then do a 6-week cycle going into the season. You know, just depending on how you feel, I guess. But yeah, 2 months is not a ton of time to build a ton of strength, but you could get in almost two lifting cycles in there if you wanted to.
So Addy, on as you say that, what type of resources, facilities, instruction do you have within the club? Because I'm a believer, and we do this with our men's program, and this is a pretty solid level, nationally ranked junior college program. And a few years ago, we got back to strength training in season, and we continued to strength train in season. We essentially had two days in the gym, and we found, and we moved it to three again. It's different because players who were playing high minutes were under a different load and did a different type of strength training, where the players that were playing lower minutes or didn't expect them to play were doing a different type of strength training. Mm-hmm. And we also had a day on the field where it was typically a Wednesday after a Tuesday match, where we did a lot of, I did a lot of work with them in terms of hip stability, hip strength, those types of things, core strength, and just basic body weight stuff. And it was part of their warm-up. We have been a long sort of slow progressive warm-up that it included some of that. And we found that some players got stronger in the season, which were typically our younger players that had been exposed to a lot of strength training, mm-hmm. but our players who'd been with us, been through a year cycle, who had started to gain some strength and power. Mm-hmm. We found that A, they enjoyed it, and B, that they at worst case were maintaining their strength with, I would say, like most people would look at it as a minimal type of strength training, but we found it effective. And even, you know, I don't have anything scientific or study behind it, but we're doing the right things. And we found our players a little more resilient later in the year and less injury prone. So, well, I mean, what do you have at your hands and fingertips and feet there that you can take advantage of?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I think strength training in season is essential. I think exactly like you said, you can build over the course of a season for sure. It's obviously the best when you can have enough staff and resources and stuff like that, where you can tailor programs to specific people. You know, one of the best things about the Courage that I saw was even their fitness programs were different for, you know, depending on how many meters you covered in training, how many meters you covered in a game. And they really, really tried to get all the players covering the same amount over the weekend. So yeah, I absolutely think strength training is really important. And we have, it's interesting because it's, you know, they have a lot of COVID restrictions right now. So all of the strength equipment is outside the stadium and we do it outside, but they have a really nice gym here and there's just a lot of staff because it's a men's program. I feel like I'm meeting someone new every day that works for the program in some capacity, which is great. So yeah, we have gym three times a week. And one of those times has kind of been testing. So whether it's like sprint testing or strength testing or the yo-yo, but you know, we have regular gym stuff twice a week, I guess you would say right now. And I think that will probably continue throughout the season. I think that's pretty normal. And especially in the women's game, it's important to do, even if it's not weight, just sort of band work and biomechanics stuff before training, just to, you know, because the incidence of ACLs and stuff like that is so high. So there's definitely a lot of that, even when we don't have a gym session, you know, practice starts with a lot of, you know, FIFA 11 and different strength things.
Can you speak to maybe our young females that may be listening, or people that coach young females, and what were some things that, if you didn't have them from a, you know, a physical preparation standpoint, you know, and Bill's probably, maybe we think more similarly than I want to admit that I think like Bill, but things that are young females or young males, but you can speak directly to our young females about things that you could have done or would have liked to have done physically outside the game that might have helped you be a better player, better goalkeeper.
Yeah, I mean, I think, sorry about that. yeah, I think obviously strength training. I actually started strength training, I think, when I was 14, which I think is a decent time. I think it doesn't really even need to be a ton of weight, but just making sure that your body's moving in the correct patterns is really important. You know, I also feel like, and I've been very lucky with injuries, and I will never say that it's something I've done versus just getting lucky, because I swear, you know, people tear their ACL doing nothing nowadays. So, you know, I do feel like I've gotten really lucky in a way, but I also do think that goalkeeper training in and of itself is a lot of agility. So you get used to sort of placing your feet properly, I guess you could say. I mean, think about how many agility ladders we've all probably done over the course of our lives, you know? So I think any kind of biomechanical movements where you're figuring out how to move your body in different directions is probably beneficial.
Kinesthetic awareness.
There it is,
yeah,
Billy.
There you go. And yeah, I didn't know that's what I was doing, but yeah. And then just learning how to lift properly, so you're not lifting a ton of weight in a pattern that's not right. I see a lot of young female goalkeepers, you know, and our knees just tend to go in sometimes when we go to jump, and yep, you really have to fight that and just teach yourself over and over again to push your knees out.
Form before function.
Addie, let me ask you this then, just as a broad strength training question. Mm-hmm. Free weights, body weight, or machines?
I tend to like free weights in general. Obviously body weight, if you're not strong enough yet, you know, form over function. Is that what you just said? But I like free weights, you know, Olympic lifts are good, but you know, I like doing single leg exercises, because I think that that's more like what you're going to do in a game. So anything that's like a split squat or a single leg RDL, those kind of things to me make more sense. So anytime you can have one arm moving independent of the other, and then obviously pairing it with an explosive movement is what works best for me. So if you are lifting heavy, you're also doing squat jumps, something like that.
Yeah, and you're also incorporating balance and stability. The stabilizing muscles also get trained then. So that's a good point. George, what do you got?
Addie, you've had an outstanding career. I mean, we go way back from the days of Soccer Plus and getting to know you as a player for PDA and, you know, and obviously going over to Yale and then to UNC, and, you know, you've continued to be now a pro. What could you share in regards to the best piece of advice for any youngster out there that wants to continue their journey?
Best piece of advice. I mean, I say this all the time, but I feel like it doesn't matter if it's not soccer, just do something that you truly enjoy doing. So even when it's hard, it's still fun. Like, to me, soccer is still a game. I still enjoy going to training when it's just training. So, you know, our team could be losing every single game, or, you know, I could not be playing. And I still have always really enjoyed training in and of itself. And I've tried to get into environments where the training is great, because that's really what counts at the end. That's where you spend 90% of your time. So if you don't enjoy the training environment, it's just not worth it. So that would be my main piece of advice. The other thing, I was just thinking about this because of when we're talking about physical things for young players, I would say that nutrition is massive and it's definitely not, it's difficult, obviously, for a lot of people. And I think figuring out what works best for you in that department is probably it's just massive. So if you can sort that out when you're young, like, that's going to be a huge advantage over the course of your career for sure as well.
Addie, if I can, I've been communicating. Do you know Kerry Sanchez?
I don't think so.
Okay. No, played at Carolina when I was there. So yeah. She's in Texas now with Ange. But I was communicating with her regarding lifting before or after training. Okay. And I've read all the literature and stuff like that. But for you, Would you prefer to lift or strength resistance train, however you want to call it, before or after soccer training?
It's interesting because I have heard, and obviously I don't, this is not my area of expertise. I had heard that strength training beforehand is not good. Like, you're more likely to get injured something when you're training. Obviously stuff on the field with bands and squatting and stuff like that, I'm not counting that, but it's interesting because the only place that I've ever strength trained before playing was with the Courage. And I actually found that in that session directly after lifting, I felt really good. Yeah. The next day I did not feel good, but that session I usually felt really good. Like, your muscles are like primed, maybe. Lifting after is hard.
Correct. Yeah. the literature, actually the science behind it is really split. Says no, it doesn't make a difference. And so, you know, I think a lot of it is comes down to, you know, for you, as you just said, you know, if your body feels really prepared for practice, you prep really well because doing that, then yeah, then do that. If you feel like, well, no, I'm better off, I'm not going to be fatigued, I don't want to be, I just want to be at 100% when I train, I'll lift after. The research is pretty much split on it. And again, the research isn't good on it because they don't define soccer practice. It's more like cardiovascular events and stuff like that. Right, so, Jeff, what do you got?
Bill, I think that, you know, some of it depends on too what the purpose of each session is. Which session is weighted heavier?
Yeah.
Is your strength session a really important session? Is it heavy, explosive power stuff? Then you do that first, because that's going to, if you go out and train for 90 minutes, that training for 90 minutes is going to negate what you might be able to do with the weight room. Anyway, sorry, Shippy.
No, well, we talked a lot about what you're doing on the field. What about off the field as a professional female? Do you guys have rock star status, or do you walk around town anonymous and no one knows who you are? Or somewhere.
I would definitely not say that we're ever rock star status. I don't know how it is here yet because we haven't really been able to leave the area, but it really depends on the team. Certain teams over here are very popular within their communities. So like the team I played for in Iceland, there were only 4,000 people on the island, and obviously everybody knew IBB and had some connection to the club. So they were very supportive of the club. Like, when we won the cup, they set fireworks off, like when our ferry came back home, and like, we're just playing songs and chanting and everything. So they're like very involved in their club. Sweden was a little bit the same, bigger town, but you know, that was the first time that the team had ever been in the first division. So when we moved up, like, we started to get really big crowds, and people started to know the women's side, because the men's club was big. But the women's side wasn't as big in the area. So, you know, people started to come out more and supporting, and definitely knew who we were. And, you know, Klepp, again, it's weird because it was a Corona year. So again, we weren't really allowed to go out, but they had a pretty good following in the area. So I would say, like, it's funny, those like small towns actually end up with more of a following than, you know, when you're playing in a big city. And obviously, you know, in Portland, that's, everybody knows the Thorns, and that's a huge soccer city. So that's sort of a different level, but I would say that that's definitely not the norm.
Well, you got free meat. I mean, you got free meat. So that's a celebrity.
Yeah. Status, yeah. Right? That too. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. In terms of if you were, again, I don't want to exaggerate or underestimate COVID, but if you had a ball, let's say a ball in yourself and 90 minutes, and that's all you had for 3 weeks, what would you do?
A ball, myself, and 90 minutes.
You got a field. Okay, we'll give you a field.
How nice of you, Ben.
So interesting. Well, I mean, when I was in Norway, we had about a month, I would say, where we were on our own. And they were giving us workouts to do. I had a mannequin base, and I had some of these like rocks that had strings tied to them that they would use to like keep the big plastic things that have your logo on them down on the field. So those were like my things that I lifted with. I filled a backpack full of books and water and used that for squatting. And so I would do like full strength sessions where I just, you know, increase the reps. And, you know, the thing about being alone in your apartment is you can write everything down. And so I would literally be like, well, I did, you know, 15 reps with the backpack and 2 bottles of water and mannequin base. So now I think I can add a stone to the top.
Found a good rock.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like literally, I had no idea how much I was lifting except in relation to last week, basically. And then obviously we had some periodized running. You know, that was like, you know, certain days were like 11 minutes on, 2 minutes off. Certain days were 4 or 5 minutes on, 2 minutes off, that kind of stuff. But, you know, with the ball, I did a lot of just individual skills, hitting the ball against the wall, setting up little mini goals. So it's like juggle the ball in the air, take a touch, hit the mini goal. It's hard. I had a lot of people asking like, what do you do like goalkeeper wise? And that, I mean, that to me is probably the hardest part, you know, like keeping your foot skills up, keeping your strength up, agility. I did a lot of like agility work and stuff like that. But the handling is obviously the hardest part. And all I can really say is that it comes back as long as you're able to like train within a, you know, a certain amount of time. That's why I say if you only have a certain amount of time, just work on physical component, because you know, the soccer stuff, it will come back to you. It's, you know, like riding a bike, you will learn to catch the ball again, you know, but the strength stuff, you're not able to really work on.
Use it or lose it kind of thing.
Yeah.
Lara, what did you have?
Yeah, it's a really good topic because I think we're going to have it. Well, in some places we're going to have a generation of players and goalkeepers that are going to go upwards of a year of not playing a match, no high speed matches, not taking a tackle, not giving a tackle, and goalkeepers that haven't truly seen a match environment for over a year for some, again, depending on the situation. So for you, the time wasn't as long, but you probably went through a long period without playing a match. What were your experiences and what were the things that took longer to adapt to and come back to, let's say, I won't say a normal level, but a level you would be okay with or expect from yourself?
Yeah, I do think it's interesting you mentioned tackling, because even when our team got back into, we kind of went through the phases of, you know, we were like completely isolated for about a month, and then we went into small group training where you had to be 2 meters apart. And then we went into full team training where there was no contact. So, you know, it was like all those games where you have a certain zone that you're allowed to be in, you can block passing lanes, but no one was putting in a tackle. And that's very, very strange. It was stranger than I thought it would be. I was like, oh, well, like, yeah, we can't have contact, but everything else will be the same. And I do think that was very strange. And the timing on tackles, which also includes goalkeepers, you know, right, the timing of getting set, the timing of, you know, when to block, when to go in, you know, for the tackle, the timing of when to get set. And some of that's based on players, you know, they maybe are taking more steps than they usually take to get a shot off because they're rusty. So there definitely is an adjustment period when you get back into it. And that was only from like maybe 2 months apart. So yeah, I would just say the timing, obviously.
Am I off base if I interpret that as reading the game, reading players?
Yeah, I think it's reading players, but I also feel like reading implies some sort of conscious thought. I feel like these are things that are normally automatic, yeah, but are not anymore because things have changed. So the reading the game component, as long as it's something that you normally think about, I feel like is okay, but it's that sort of getting comfortable. But it's weird because for me, I have that same problem anytime I come into a new team. So anytime you change a defender out, you have to get to know them a little bit. So it was on a bigger scale, but I do think that's something that you have to adjust to anyway a lot.
Yeah, no, I know I reading probably wasn't the best word. If I just said kind of like reading the rhythm of a shooter or reading the rhythm as somebody's preparing to strike a ball, things like that. That's the thing. I wasn't referring to like reading the entire game. Or,
yeah.
You know, I've got my backs and I've got my midfielder. This is what's going to happen. No, I just meant more, a little more singular perhaps in the sense of somebody preparing and striking a ball. Just that rhythm that goes on. Okay. But that can lead me to one other thing that I, and again, I'm just kind of like thinking of things that I've, how my, I don't know, coaching has evolved with goalkeepers. And I think one of the biggest things is just reading the rhythm of the striker in terms of how I'm closing them down, getting set. And again, and I'm not trying to get whatever, but you remember from, I'm going to use Soccer Plus terminology, but the pre-stretch. You know, where you are loading up, which is actually a concept in physiology, the pre-stretch. It's an eccentric contraction immediately prior to a concentric contraction. And you do that, but you just kind of like read it and flow. And that rhythm is something that I find, as I looked at younger goalkeepers, that I see lacking somewhat. And I don't know when I developed it. It was so long ago. I don't know when I developed that. But just reading that rhythm of the shooter and getting comfortable in that, your timing is synced to their timing.
Mm-hmm.
Did that occur as a conscious moment for you, or did that just evolve, or is that something you can train? What do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like I've, in the last few years, become a bit more aware of when players are doing shooting drills. You know how we're always like, this isn't realistic, you know, or whatever. And people are like, well, like people shoot from everywhere. And I'm like, it's not the distance that's unrealistic. It's the rhythm of the shooter. And I think that that's what's sometimes strange. You know, it can be any drill, but if they take a touch and they take three steps and then they shoot, that's just not something that really happens in a game because that window closes, right? I mean, most of the time it's touch shot or touch step shot, you know, touch step shot at the most. And so I think there's definitely a rhythm that, and I don't know if you necessarily need to be in a game situation, because I think obviously the more you play, the more you're going to get used to the rhythm of play. But I do think it's something that, you know, coaches should probably be aware of when they set up any kind of finishing drill is, are the movements realistic? Is the timing realistic? You know, is the rhythm of the shooter realistic, or at least encouraging them to have that normal rhythm? Because it's not really helping them either if it's not going to happen in a game. So,
yeah, no, I started thinking about that more when, do you know Greg Kenny? The people that are smiling and grinning,
yes. You can say no.
And we're chatting about this and we talked about how when, If a striker whiffs, if in other words, somehow their last touch bobbles and they just whiff, how we would stumble because we were all set. Like, they're not going to screw this up. They're going to shoot. And then they didn't. And they're like, they didn't actually shoot. And you yourself would stumble based on their stumble. It was always just an interesting idea.
There is a book. Oh, man, I can't remember the name of it. Now, I must have read it like 5 years ago, and it was about I think it was about like the genetics of athletes. I can't remember it now, but it might have been that one. It was basically talking about baseball players and how the pitch, the time that it takes for the ball to get to the plate, like you actually can't physically react to.
Oh yeah, no, that it's the same same thing with penalty kicks. Penalty kicks take around 500 to 700 microseconds to go from the spot to the goal, and your reaction time is, you know, a little bit more than 500 microseconds. It's like,
yeah, so like physiologically, like they shouldn't be able to hit a baseball.
yeah,
because they're like reading basically the body language of the pitcher, they are able to obviously hit the pitches. And so I think there's definitely a lot of that in goalkeeping, right? Like, you know, we talk a lot about cheating in drills, but I mean, half of goalkeeping must be cheating, you know, in a game, right? Like based on body shape and
experience.
So, like it's definitely not a full reaction. You're always reading body language, reading the pace of the ball, the skin, that kind of stuff.
Cool.
We Rattle. Don't cheat. Come on.
Yeah. Just the, you know, and I know we're getting close to the end here, but it brings up a good point about as goalkeepers, the idea of playing other sports or other activities. And so Addie, maybe you can comment to you and if you, what other sports you played, but relative to that sort of timing and the pre-stretch that Bill talks mm-hmm. about, it's not just a goalkeeping thing because Bill said it's a physical, physiological terminology. Tennis is huge because every time a ball gets hit, especially on a serve, watch the tennis player that receives a ball mm-hmm. and their movement in terms of a slight step forward into resetting, you know, off an eccentric loading pattern to get reset. It's sort of like taking the spring and letting it come up and then squeezing it back down so it can unload. But mm-hmm. we don't see it only in tennis. We see it in other sports, and baseball is another one. If baseball players are doing it right, if you looked across the baseball field, other than the pitcher and the catcher, every other player has some sort of preparation step or preparation movement before, as the, whatever the timing is, when the ball gets thrown or when it's about, when they perceive that it's about to be struck by a bat. And it's very similar to goalkeeping. So I think when goalkeepers can play other sports, and it could be volleyball too, because volleyball, you see the same thing. Volleyball, tennis, baseball, whatever the other sport is, I think you just become more adept at reading, or if you, like you said, cheating, reading what is coming and being prepared for that and being able to react to the different scenarios. So what was your background athletically, and was there anything that you felt helped you prepare to be a better goalkeeper from that standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would say, like, as a young kid, I played other sports. I mean, at some point I danced for sure when I was younger. I played hockey. Well, really I was a figure skater, and then they were like, oh, you can skate. Why don't you play hockey? So I played hockey.
Adelaide, the dancing goalkeeper.
Yeah.
But it was full contact figure skating.
There you go. Yeah, I know. They're like, and I literally, that's all I could do. I could skate. I could skate forward and backward. I could skate, but I could not do anything with the puck. So I literally was just a defenseman, got in the way, hit people. It was actually fun, but not a skill player at all. And then I played tennis when I was younger. And I always joke, like, I'm not naturally athletic, which is not true. I am, like, naturally, like, I have a base of athleticism, but I wouldn't say that I'm someone that, you know, steps up to the basketball hoop at Dave and Buster's and just, like, throws down, you know, baskets. You know, like, whatever I've done, it's been, like, a very consistent pattern of putting in, like, hours to, like, be good at it physically. So, yeah, but I do think I had a lot of general athletic experience, but I wouldn't say that I was, like, a skill player in any of those sports.
But those all provide high value, I think. And we've said it before, and I just believe we have a generation of, and I'll just specifically goalkeepers, that just don't play other sports. Do they become better goalkeepers? Yeah. But I mean, George talked about throwing a ball. I don't know if we were recording when we were talking about that, maybe not, but, you know, I'm seeing goalkeepers that struggle to throw a ball because they've never thrown a baseball, never thrown a softball, never thrown anything, or never done anything to hit a tennis ball, or anything with an overhead motion. So I just think that there's value out there in doing something, at least for parts of the year, that can make you a better goalkeeper through other sporting activities.
Look, and there's strong, I'll say, yeah. You know what, I played a lot of sports when I was a kid, baseball, and then I was a very big tennis, I was actually more of a tennis player in high school than a soccer player. But I think it's what the term that they use in literature is sometimes called sports sampling. And sports mm-hmm. sampling when you're young is very good because you develop a lot of physical literacy. In other words, I know how to fall. I know how to not fall. Mm-hmm. I know how to turn a corner and maintain my balance and not fall over. I can judge the flight of a ball. And that's always been one of my issues with young female keepers. I grew up playing catch with my dad like every night. You come home from school every night, we go and play catch, and you just learn to float a ball. You can read the float of the ball. Mm-hmm. And until kids grow up doing things like that, the, just the, you touched upon it yourself, the repetition, the number of repetitions I got from floating, you know, seeing the flight of a ball and getting my hand to catch it, hundreds of millions. But kids that don't do that are lacking that. And I think that's what, you know, again, we're probably showing our positions.
Knowledge. We're showing here, our knowledge.
Our wisdom. Our
knowledge.
Yeah.
Our age.
Of that.
There you go.
All the above. All the above. All the above.
Pipe down, El Gigante.
George, did you have something?
No, but I think the analogy that Lotto was talking about in regards to, you know, the pre-stretch, you would see that as an infielder. But how it pertains to goalkeeping also is if you're in the outfield, the ability to read a flight of the ball, like when you're reading across, you know, as and if you've played outfield, if you start coming in right away, that ball's going over your head. And it's the same on crosses when you take that first step too quickly. So the ability to read the flight of the ball, like what you're talking about, Billy, is so essential as a kid when you are participating in sports sampling, because I owe so much to that. You know, I think the generations and society, it's so different for kids now, because, you know, you could go to a field and spend 3 or 4 hours. You spend 3 or 4 hours at a field now, you know, somebody's going to come over and be like, where's your parents?
Yeah.
So,
well, it's John Wooden's 8 laws of learning: explanation, demonstration, imitation, repetition, 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 repetition. There's your 8 laws.
Patty. Hey, Bill, my last question for you, when you talked about sports sampling.
Yes.
Is what you're talking about the same that if we go to a sports bar and order a flight of beers, watch 4 different sports and sample 5 different beers, is that the same or is it different?
Oh, no, because again, that definitely affects your spatial awareness. The flight of the beer. Anyway, Addie, we don't want to take up more of your time, but this has been great. Just such a fun conversation. We bounce all over the place. But that's the beauty of it. We bounce all over the place. It's been great. So we just want to say thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed that episode at the Goalkeeper Roundtable. If you'd like to reach out with suggestions, comments, or questions, all of our email addresses are available in the show description. If you like the show, we'd love for you to subscribe to it, but also share it in social media platforms or with any other goalkeeper or coach who may find value in it. We hope you turn in to the next Goalkeeper Roundtable.